Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. And now, time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
You know, we think that the governor selected the least qualified candidate. This is a politician who has shown during his tenure that he cannot disregard his own personal biases. And I think that's, we believe, that he's got a destructive civil liberties record and doesn't belong on the court.
Elections have consequences. The voters of this state voted Doug Ducey in 14, and they reelected him in 2018. And part of being governor is getting to make these judicial appointments, and that's their legacy.
Mr. Brandt, your behavior is that of a kingpin who operates a company to mainly benefit himself.
I would ask that you make a public commitment here today and now that during your tenure in that position or positions, that you would not permit or allow the companies to be participants in any election of any corporation commissioner.
I'm not in the role yet, Mr. Chairman, and so I'm not in a position today to answer that question.
It's up to Congress to create the laws. Congress has to solve this problem, and instead what's happened is DACA recipients are being used as political footballs by both parties.
And with us to talk about Bill Montgomery being named Arizona's next Supreme Court Justice, along with the head of APS facing the Corporation Commission and more, our former legislative leader Chad Campbell of Strategies 360, and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chad, not a big surprise, I guess, that Bill Montgomery got the choice, but considering Governor Ducey could have named three other conservative people probably, why Montgomery, you think?
That's hard to sit here and give a definitive answer on that one. I think probably a couple things were at play. I think, first of all, this is a nod to the base on his side. You know, Montgomery is popular with the more farther right base of the Republican Party. And I think a lot of the people in that inner circle of that base viewed Montgomery as the next chosen one for that seat, right? He was kind of ordained, no pun intended, for that seat. And then secondly, I think that, you know, Governor Ducey and Montgomery have a longstanding relationship that goes back for several years. And I think that that was part of the decision calculus probably on Ducey's part. How this will play out in the long run, though, will be interesting. I thought that Governor Ducey had an opportunity to appoint a female, maybe get some diversity on the court, and went the opposite direction. So it's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, I'm thinking really everything that Chad said. And I think his last pick of Clint Bullock was another example of the other wing of the party, although Bullock is an independent, but the more kind of libertarian-leaning, fiscal conservative, but socially open to things, and Bill Montgomery's more the social conservative. So I think that part of the party did want a candidate that they felt represented them.
John, do you get the sense that having Montgomery on the court changes the court? I mean, obviously, he's replacing Scott Bales, who was appointed by a Democrat, the only Democrat on the court. But does having Montgomery on the court, does that change the way that decisions might come out, do you think?
I think it might. We'll have to see. I'm not in the business of predicting jury decisions or high court decisions because so much of that deliberation is behind the scenes. But it will give a more kind of political background to things, and people will really be watching to try to hold his feet to the fire as far as avoiding playing politics with the judicial system.
It's obviously very difficult, as John alluded to predict what a court is going to do. But does his presence there change the dynamic in any way, do you think?
Yeah, I think you're talking about replacing Justice Bales, who was, you know, much more of a kind of a centrist Democrat. I think he, you know, played that role well in the court. It was very moderate, very pragmatic in his decisions, with really a very socially conservative person. I mean, Bill Montgomery is kind of cut from the cloth of Kathy Herod and that group. So it may not change some of the decisions around kind of more, to John's point, the economic, traditionally conservative type of focus decision-making. But when it comes to the social issues around, you know, women's reproductive rights, things like that. This could alter that court drastically, and that's a concerning factor for many of us.
Chad, let me come back to the politics of this, though, based on what Governor Ducey has to gain or not. I mean, he won re-election easily. We don't know what his future is. Does he somehow end up in a second-term Trump cabinet? Does he end up running for some different higher office? But as far as the base goes, has the state Supreme Court become more of a focus for people? Because, as Mark mentioned, it's going to be 7 Republicans, no Democrats. This is not like a swing vote as it would be at the U.S. Supreme Court. So I guess I'm sort of coming back to the idea, what does he gain or lose politically by doing this?
Well, you know, here's my theory on this. I always get in trouble when I throw out theories, but I'll do it anyways. I think the Republicans know the state's changing. I think you're going to see a pretty drastic change next cycle. I think you're going to see the Democrats take a chamber, probably the House. I think in 2022, you're going to elect a Democratic governor in the state. I think you're going to see some other statewide offices go Democratic, which we saw this last cycle. 3 statewide seats went Democratic this time around. I think you're going to have 2 Democratic U.S. senators after this election next year. And so I think this was kind of the last heave-ho from Governor Ducey to put a pretty staunch Republican court in place to kind of be that check in that system of checks and balances, to be perfectly honest. Because I think the demographic trends in the state, if you look at the legislative districts, everything is starting to trend Democratic in the state, with some of the exceptions of the rural county areas. But otherwise, the trend lines are pretty clear, and I think Governor Ducey probably saw the writing on the wall.
Jen, did Chad have too much coffee this morning?
Way
it's
too
iced
much
tea,
coffee.
By the way, not coffee, just so you know. So.
That's good. I can never have too much coffee. I think it's definitely a bulwark against any kind of changes in the future, but the state is trending more purple. The state traditionally is a purple state. We have not been a hard rock-ribbed red state for most of our history. It's kind of balanced between parties. Our background is very Democratic. If you go back a few decades, we've had almost even number of Democrats and Republicans. And this past decade or so has been an odd era of Republican dominance. And as we saw in 2018, that's fading away.
John, from Bill Montgomery's perspective, he obviously is aware of the criticisms against him leading up to and from the, including his appointment to the court. Does that change how he might act when he gets there? I mean, is it the kind of thing where he might try to maybe soften a little bit or maybe just sort of observe for a little while to sort of maybe try to prove the critics, hey, look, I'm here to learn. I'm here to just do the job of a justice. All that other stuff was in a previous job.
I think Bill Montgomery does not care what people think of him. That's the thing. He has his base, and he has his beliefs, and he's very strong in those beliefs. And he's fine with taking the slings and arrows, as it were. I don't see him growing in office, let's say, moderating his views. I think he's very firm on these views and has been for many years.
Not even the moderating or changing his views, but just sort of maybe the way he conducts himself in once he's a justice. I mean, we've heard, you know, he's not going to do interviews for a little while. But other than that, I mean, do you think he changes his behavior at all, maybe?
I tend to agree with John on this one. I think if you know Bill Montgomery, he's kind of who he is. And, you know, you can agree or disagree with that. I think the big question, though, kind of to this question is, can he actually remove himself from the political work that he does? Because he can no longer do that. I mean, legally, he can no longer do a lot of the political stuff he does. Can he adeptly, evolve to accept that? Or is it just so far in his blood that he's going to still try to nibble around the edges and get himself into trouble? I think he's smart enough not to do that. But that's the big question is, can he evolve with his new role and stay out of the political aspect of just that job and the environment in general.
Resist the temptation to get involved in the marijuana campaign, for example.
Yeah, well, no comment on that one.
Guys, I want to move on to the county attorney and where this leaves that office. John, let me ask you about that sort of going forward. This is really going to be quite a battleground. Chad's talking about some of the different offices that could go D or stay R or whatnot. This is really an opening. There are a lot of Democratic attorneys that live in Maricopa County. I'm sure that many of them are sizing this up. What do you think of that going forward?
I think they definitely have a good chance. And again, we're past the era. And that's the thing. Bill Montgomery, in a lot of ways, is kind of a throwback to the early 90s, tough on crime, anti-criminal justice reform kind of mentality. And I think with most voters, you know, you have the President Trump out there pushing criminal justice reform. So let alone moderates, either in the Democratic or the Republican wings, are going to want a different approach on things. We have the big marijuana legalization bill or vote coming up. So I think the public is definitely changing on these things, and it's not going to be this kind of Andy Thomas Arpaio kind of conservative, put people in tent cities kind of thing. You're going to want someone who's a little more up to date on criminal justice reform efforts and how can we actually help these people instead of just locking them up.
Yeah, Chad, politically, what do you think this looks like for the Democrats?
Yeah, you know, we've had some people that have already thrown their hat in the ring. I think with this departure now, you're going to probably at least see some more higher profile Democrats looking at this seat with probably greater fundraising capacity. And I think, again, to John's point, I think if you're a Democrat, if you can strike that balance between being supportive of public safety while also talking about the need to work with some of the communities that have been probably unjustly treated by public safety and working on some of that criminal justice reform, if you can strike a balance as a Democrat, I think you can win that seat next year.
Safe to say it's not only going to be a lot of Democrats lining up for that seat?
Yeah, I mean, from what I know, I guess Bill Gates is already looking at that seat from what I've heard, and
county
I've heard
supervisor.
Some other names. Yeah, county supervisor Bill Gates. Yeah, not Microsoft Bill Gates, which doesn't hurt the other Bill Gates, so I want to point that out. But, I, you know, he's looking at, I've heard some other Republicans.
We heard Rick Romney's name again.
Yeah, I've heard that name as well. So well,
my entire life I've heard that.
So I'm going to throw out my own crazy theory, okay, going back to the Montgomery being selected. So you mentioned criminal justice reform, John. We know that Governor Ducey has gotten the support of the Koch organization over the years. Koch organization generally across the country has pushed for criminal justice reform. Bill Montgomery does not like that. Do you think there was any situation there where someone may have said to Governor Ducey, you know, we already know you like Bill Montgomery. Let's get him out of the way of criminal justice reform.
Oh, yeah. That definitely could be a case because I know a lot of people were disappointed with Bill Montgomery as a choice for that reason. It's just like, no, we need someone who's a little more open-minded to these things, these reforms that we obviously need, looking at the incarceration stats. We always have debates locally about for-profit prisons, things like that. And, yeah, now he can't oppose it legislatively, let's say, or just in his role in Maricopa County. So,
Chad, what do you make of these sort of rumblings that we've been hearing, especially from some folks on the left, about how, while they're not thrilled necessarily that Montgomery is on the Supreme Court now, maybe he has less power there, maybe sort of getting him out of the way to Steve's question.
Yeah, I mean, that is a plausible scenario here. And again, I think it all depends on who gets elected to that seat to, you know, follow up on Bill Montgomery's tenure there. But it definitely removes, in many ways, a political obstacle that's been in the way of the criminal justice reform that many of us on the Democratic side and some on the Republican side have been working on for many years now. And so I think there's a glimmer of hope from that aspect for us. But again, when it comes back to we have an expanded Supreme Court now that is pretty much, you know, a very conservative-leaning court, obviously, the long-term implications of that on some of the big-ticket issues we're going to be looking at in this state are concerning to many of us. So we'll see how this all plays out.
I'm curious, quickly, for both of you, when the County Board of Supervisors appoints the replacement for Montgomery, would you expect them to be looking for somebody who's looking to run next year or not looking to run next year?
I think they would go with a placeholder of some type, and I think that would be a wise move. Ultimately, let the people decide the future of that office, I think, is more important than setting someone up for success later on.
Yeah, I would agree. I think they're going to try to find somebody just as a temporary placeholder.
I'm going to squeeze in kind of a final This Is Your Life, Bill Montgomery. Considering when we first heard about Bill Montgomery, he was destroyed by Terry Goddard in the race for Attorney General, if I remember right, and now he's Arizona Supreme Court Justice. Based on minimal or a lot of experience you guys have had with him, does it surprise you that he's ended up at this level?
Persistence in politics pays off. That's all I can say about that. I think that holds true a lot of times.
Yeah, definitely. And his name has been bandied about for several years and for previous nominations. So not really surprised. Probably would have been if you told me this when he was running against Goddard.
Yeah. That's John Gabriel. Also here is Chad Campbell with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. It is the Friday Newscap here on the show on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our panelists today, former legislative leader Chad Campbell of Strategies 360 and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. All right, Chad. APS, Don Brandt, went before the Corporation Commission this week. very tense. He didn't actually speak all that much. There were a lot of discussions from his attorney. But there were a lot of different questions about what's going on there, some political, some otherwise. Let's talk about the politics of this first. Are you surprised that there was so much emphasis on what APS had done and how much they had spent in the past?
No, I mean, this was, you know, this is like primetime political theater here, right? I remember talking to you guys about this a couple months ago, thinking Don Brandt would never go before the Corporation Commission. So he proved me wrong. I think we all expected it to be a very tense discussion, some very heated points being made. You know, some of the tangential places they went, though, especially Bob Burns, was interesting to me along the lines of going down the Governor Ducey pathway and some of that line of questioning and trying to connect dots. But it wasn't unexpected. And I think at the end of the day, I'm not sure much actually will come out of this. It really is. The question now is, what is APS going to do moving forward under their new leadership? And that's what everybody wants to see now. And I think they're indicating and hinting they're going to probably take a different tactic moving forward, is my guess.
Yeah. John?
Yeah, it was just like watching a hostile witness. Brand did not talk a whole lot. It was just, let me confer with my lawyer, I declare the fifth kind of a thing. And it was just a public airing of grievances. It was like Festivus, just everybody saying, all right, what about the time you did this, and what about the time you did that? So it was, I'm sure cathartic for politicians, but it won't result in much.
Did we learn anything from this hearing?
Dead silence. Yeah, that is a bad thing.
Maybe no.
Not really, because, it was just basically APS playing defense and trying to disclose as little as possible. The answers that were given were just kind of the, you know, corporate speak, kind of mealy mouth, you know, I will talk but not tell you anything type answers.
Well, so is that why Brandt went on then? I mean, just to show, hey, we're sort of playing ball here with the Corporation Commission?
I think it was a PR move to some degree, because he didn't learn anything new in that hearing. At least I didn't. I mean, for those of us who have been following this and you know, working in the space for a while now, everything that was talked about was all public at this point, which is why it could be talked about in that hearing, right? So I think it was more of a PR move. And in some ways, though, I also think it was more of a kind of Don Brandt's final swan song and kind of handing this off to Goldner to take over and really kind of passing the baton in front of the commissioners. This is my thought, at least on this, and making sure the commissioners know there's a new person in charge and they can start working with him. And I think that's really what this was. It's very ceremonial. It's like, you know, Survivor or something, passing the torch or whatever.
Nobody voted off the island.
Yeah, not yet anyways. Yeah.
Well, so for people who maybe aren't paying attention to this as closely as someone like you are and hasn't been following this all that closely, if they tuned in or read about this particular hearing, does it change anything for APS or for the commission or for APS customers, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. I think most people are fairly aware of what's been going on. When we deal with different issues and talk to different people across the state, most people seem to be aware of some of the stuff around the Corporation Commission and APS's involvement in some of that political work. And people have mixed reactions to that. But I think for the most part, most voters probably look at this as just politics as usual, more of the same. And the Corporation Commission in general, I think, has kind of turned the corner over the past year or two and started to try to restore some faith and some trust and a different operating mode with the utilities they regulate. And so we'll see how that plays out in the next election cycle. That's really my question, is how does this play on 2020, being the political guy, and who gets elected and what kind of message they run on? That's really going to be fascinating to me.
The one piece of information that I don't think we did know is that the FBI investigation is continuing. That seemed to be sort of a bomb.
Right,
yeah,
right.
So that's sort of a bombshell.
That was something that a lot of people just forgot about, including myself. And, it's still continuing. They said, it should be over soon, but I'm not sure what that means. How is it going to be over? So,
yeah, John, do you think the APS in the future, based on whether Jeff Goldner takes him in that direction or just Jessica Pacheco takes him in that direction, will it be slightly more subtle, perhaps? Like maybe not the corporation commissioners will be involved in how much money they give?
I would think so, just because they're going to have to change a little bit because they've been getting so much blowback lately the past few years about political contributions and rate hikes and campaigns. A lot of knives are out among establishment, be it, you know, politicians on every level, you know, county, state, whatever. And I think they are trying to mend fences. And this was, frankly, it wasn't a very revealing talk, but it was a good start.
Chad, no pun intended, but is there a disconnect between what APS leaders see? Because the APS, you know, we see the great ads, and apparently APS is fairly popular among its customers. But when it comes down to Don Brandt sitting there and not really realizing that if, in fact, utility payers' money was going toward political ads, that maybe that's not a good thing?
Yeah. And this is a complicated one. You know, this is a APS has tried to kind of split the hairs on this one for years now. And I don't want to get in the weeds on that one, but they've been trying to say that, oh, this money doesn't come from our customers. It comes from our other activities. And that's debatable. But I think the big question, you know, they've indicated and they've stated they're not going to be using any type of dark money activity moving forward. And if that's the case, you know, I applaud them for that. But where are they going to spend that money and how is what everybody's going to be watching. And they've been fairly partisan for the most part for the past few years. I think everybody knows that. That's no secret. So, you know, will they broaden their political activity, be less partisan, be more focused on kind of supporting a diverse group of organizations, candidates, everything else? You know, those are questions they have to answer internally. But I'm assuming they're having very serious conversations about those types of questions. And again, I think, you know, they can repair what's been done over the past several years if they take the right steps, but they have to work on that. They can't just kind of sweep it on the rug and hope it goes away is my point.
Chad, I want to ask you about one of the tangents you referenced earlier, which is Bob Burns kind of going off on the governor a little bit during that hearing and essentially accusing the governor of trying to sow discontent on the commission and cause disruptions and everything like that. What did you make of that?
That was actually like the most fascinating part of the hearing to me. I did not see that one coming and you know, kind of some shots at former Commissioner Tobin and some other things there. You know, if you know Bob Burns, it's not surprising that he takes this on because Bob never really shied away from any fight, and I served with him in the legislature. But, you know, I don't know what the legitimacy of that is, but there, if you look at the history, I mean, Tobin did try to do some things that would have diminished the power of the Corporation Commission. There are definitely some outside influences trying to take some of their authority and give it to the legislature, and so I think Burns was, you know, on to something. I don't know if he was being a little too conspiracy theory driven, but I think there's where there's smoke, there's fire type of mentality.
John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think if there is any chance of fire, it's good that he did bring it up and just air it. Basically, they just wanted to, it was like a pressure cooker wanting to release a little steam that has just built up over years with APS. And any kind of question or suspicion or frustration they've had, they could just let it go. I think that's ultimately good for APS and them, just so they can start a new relationship with a new leader. I think as the state tends to be more purple now than it was, they would be very wise to reach out to both sides and just make sure, hey, we're all in this together on the same page. We might not agree on everything, but it would be a wiser strategy, I think, going forward.
John, let's squeeze in one more quick topic. We had Attorney General Mark Brnovich on the program earlier this week talking about his support of the Trump administration, he and 11 other attorneys general, related to DACA, trying to phase it out, that kind of thing. And Brnovich may disagree with Chad's assertion that there will be a Democrat in the governor's office in 2022. But what do you think about him taking this on? Because this seems like a tough issue because he seems like someone who actually may support DACA recipients, but not. He's also trying to sort of skirt this.
Right. I'm not surprised by this. I think it's very much of this is the letter of the law. These DACA rules were put in place by executive order. Trump tried to eliminate them by executive order, and they were held up in the courts. And he's like, well, if you can create it by executive order, you can get rid of it by executive order. So I think he really is, he's someone who will stick to the letter of the law very particularly, even if it cuts against his own self-interest a lot of times.
Hmm. Chad, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not an attorney. I am purely a political hack, so I will use that as my lens here.
Very good political hack, Chad.
From talking about the governor's race in 2022 with the changing demographics of the state, I think it's personally a bad move for Brnovich to be pursuing this if he is looking to run for governor. I think the majority of the population supports DACA. I think that sentiment is only going to grow, and that growing population of the Latino community in particular is probably not going to look favorably on Mark Brnovich's role in all of this. And I think that's going to come back to haunt him in 2022.
Does it matter, do you think, politically for Brnovich, what the high court does here?
No, I don't think so. I think he has defined his role, and that's what people are going to remember in 2022.
Yeah, and I think all state politicians, especially on the GOP side, are trying to thread this. How can How much of a team player can we be, basically, so we don't look like we're disloyal to our party, disloyal to the president, but we don't want to touch all the toxic stuff going on. So it's a dance that any GOP candidate in 50 states is trying to figure out.
Okay, gentlemen, less than a minute left. John, I'll start with you. We didn't tell you we were going to talk about this, but NFL season starts this weekend. Cardinals have a new head coach, a new quarterback. Did they win more than three games?
Yes, they do. They win four. but, of course, the Green Bay Packers will be taking yet another ring. So go okay. Pack, go.
Yeah, Chad, are you optimistic about this?
I am not optimistic. I'm still very, very upset about how they handled the Rosen situation. Yeah, I think three would be a good ceiling to look for if I was a Cardinals fan, which I am a Cardinals fan. I think three is where you should set your aspirations.
And for public
year.
Radio fans who are not NFL fans, that means they would go three wins and 13 losses. So they're
fantastic.
Chad Campbell of Strategies 360, John Gabriel of Ricochet.com. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. Stay tuned. Coming up this morning at 10, we'll bring you The Takeaway. Recent figures, including those released by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration within the Department of Health and Human Services, indicate that marijuana use among young people between the ages of 12 and 17 is remaining relatively steady at around 12.5%. But that figure may not be consistent when it comes to use of a cannabis concentrate. ASU Assistant Professor Madeline Meyer in the university's Department of Psychology recently led a study that looked at answers on marijuana use by 50,000 8th through 12th graders. And she's with me to talk about the results. Madeline, first, what's the difference between cannabis concentrate and the more common form of marijuana that's used?
So marijuana refers to a particular preparation of the cannabis plant, and that's the flower, the bud. And it's what most people are used to thinking of when they think of marijuana or the word cannabis. Cannabis concentrates or marijuana concentrates refer to a product that uses the cannabis plant like marijuana, but instead of preparing it like buds or leaves, like marijuana, what they do is they use a solvent to extract the THC in a highly concentrated product that looks a lot different than the marijuana buds and leaves. It instead looks like maybe a brittle substance that shatters easily. It can look waxy, and it can even just be a clear liquid.
Based on the percentage of the teens who said that they'd used marijuana and a pretty good percentage, almost a quarter had used concentrate, tell me why that is so significant.
Sure. So we found that 33% of the 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in Arizona reported that they had used cannabis at some point in their life, and that's consistent with what we see in nationally representative norms, so data collected on adolescents in the 8th, 10th, and 12th grades across the United States. What we did was something that hasn't really been done before and asked these adolescents not only if they'd used cannabis, but if they'd used that particular very high THC form of cannabis called concentrate, and we found that 24% of them said that they had used. So almost one in four 8th, 10th, and 12th graders had used concentrate, and that's potentially concerning because the concentrate does contain very high concentrations of THC, which is the psychoactive constituent of cannabis. And we know that THC has dose effects on things like cognitive impairment, psychotic-like experiences. We're concerned that it's possible that by using these very highly concentrated THC products, the concentrates, kids may be putting themselves at higher risk for these negative outcomes. Now, the study wasn't able to address that issue. We simply asked how often kids were, or how many kids were using. The significance of this is, you know, that this is a highly potent cannabis product that has the potential to alter functioning if kids are using it frequently.
So there's reason to believe that it would have a larger impact on a young person's mind than it would on an adult, probably.
There's some evidence to suggest that adolescents are particularly vulnerable to the effects of THC on brain function and structure and on cognitive function. We know it's very clear that adolescents who use cannabis are at higher risk for becoming addicted than adults who use. So, yeah, there's a concern that adolescent use is particularly worrisome.
So are there other sort of basic risks to using this?
Researchers are just starting to study it and get a handle on what's happening. But there is concern that these types of products will contain residual solvent. So they're made with toxic solvents like butane. And it's possible that there is butane left over in the product that people are using. So that's one potential health concern. Another health concern that we've already seen, for example, in states like California and Colorado, is that making the concentrate can be very risky, again, because it involves handling of these flammable solvents. And so we've seen explosions, for example, in homes where there's concentrate being made. Mm. It's pretty risky to make them. And then finally, the third risk is that some methods of using concentrate, so how people are using it, involve using a blowtorch. Oh. And the blowtorch is necessary to really heat the concentrate. And I think it's really scary to think that kids who are getting high also have their hands on a blowtorch, which can lead to burns.
As you said, there's just been some studying. What do you want to try to do next?
I think the next question is whether the use of these very high THC cannabis products amplify an adolescent's risk for addiction. It could be, for example, that adolescents simply use less of the cannabis when there's a lot of THC. And in that case, it wouldn't increase their risk any more than marijuana. On the other hand, I don't know how good adolescents are at what's called titrating their use, using less when the THC content is high. And so I want to know if they titrate, and if not, does that have an effect on their risk for addiction, their cognitive function, their psychotic-like experiences, things of that nature.
Madeline Meyer is an assistant professor in ASU's Department of Psychology.
There are a lot of cameras along Valley roadways looking for speeders and red light runners, but some are called ALPRs, or automated license plate readers. These cameras can scan the license plates on vehicles as they drive past and store that information for law enforcement agencies to use later. Phoenix-based independent journalist Yael Grauer has been looking into these ALPRs and wrote about what she found in the Arizona Mirror. I spoke with her and asked her to define a term used within some police departments, gridding.
Gridding is described as driving up and down every street in an area to capture every single license plate in the area, and that's done through automated license plate readers.
And what do the police departments do with this information?
So these are high-speed cameras, and sometimes they're not all gridded. They're not all used by driving down the street. Some of them are mounted on street poles or fake cactus. Some of them are attached to police cars. But basically, the information is collected and put in a database. It's often shared with thousands of other agencies. And police can use it. Well, they say that they use it to be able to find out where a plate has been in the past, to see if there was a vehicle at the scene of a crime, or to look at travel patterns or associations, or find lost vehicles and that kind of thing. But it can actually be used for other reasons. You can kind of paint a really intimate, detailed portrait of everybody's life, where they've been, you know, health centers, immigration clinics, that kind of thing, mosques.
Is there evidence that any Valley law enforcement agencies are using this information for reasons maybe they shouldn't be using it, or reasons other than what they're saying they're using it for?
I mean, I think the big issue is not, are you using a license plate nefariously on purpose? Because when you capture just large amounts of information on everybody over time, that can create disparate policing. So for example, if I am a police officer in a low-income community of color and I find a petty crime, then I might want to go back to that community over and over again. And there's definitely evidence that in other states that automated license plate readers have disproportionately targeted poor people and people of color, because it kind of creates this cycle where you find a petty crime and then you send more police there and find more petty crimes and just kind of disproportionately police specific areas.
What do privacy advocates say about all this? I would imagine they're not super thrilled with it.
Oh, yeah. No, privacy advocates are very much against this. If somebody was hanging out outside of your mosque or your synagogue or a gun shop or your doctor or a union hall or a protest just copying down every single license plate, then I think that would be a little bit creepy. And for it to be able to do thousands of plates a minute, normally policing would be limited by just the ability to surveil people based on time. And just the fact that you're using machines that can do this so quickly, it can create a chilling effect, and maybe people might be less likely to go to the places where they want to go. It's also been shared, just the amount of sharing that's done. It's been shared with ICE and other places. The other issue for privacy is that everybody has to have a license plate on their car. So it's not like you can withhold this information. And it's legal to park near a crime or to live in a poor neighborhood where there might be crime. But it can make it look like you are associated with that crime if your car just happens to be near these crimes.
Is this technology vastly different than just like a surveillance camera that businesses and police agencies and individual homeowners have used for years and years?
Well, it is a camera. It's a high-speed camera. And I think the difference is that surveillance cameras are usually limited to location, like they're stationary. You know, ALPR, some of them are stationary and some of them are mobile. And then also just the databases. Normally when you have a surveillance camera, you're not sending all the data and sending it to hundreds of other agencies and having it stored in a database for extensive periods of time. Usually people will delete, I don't know if this is always the case, but just because of memory concerns, like usually it's deleted. And you don't kind of keep looking at the people after you've recorded them if they haven't done anything. So, you know, some people think that you should get a warrant to be able to look up license plate information and that it shouldn't be stored if it's not on a hot list because you're basically tracking people's movement everywhere. But yeah, I guess it's true that surveillance cameras do sometimes target certain communities. So yeah, it's similar in some ways, but it's different in other ways.
All right. That's Yael Grauer, an independent journalist based here in Phoenix. Yael, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The cops, look out there!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute.
Now that's a proper introduction. Okay.
SETI, the search for extraterrestrial. There are so many questions that I'd like to ask you. I hardly even know where to begin. Have people from your world been here before?
Before, yes. We are interested in your species.
What's that?
A very unpleasant little creature.
What's his problem?
He's got a cold.
Just about everybody works in a post office as an alien.
All right, Steve, knowing you like I do, I'm guessing you probably recognize most of those scenes.
Well, some of them are. War of the Worlds, Men in Black, E.T., also Arrival was in there?
Of course, plus Starman and Flight of the Navigator.
Okay, so here's the most cogent question mark.
Yes.
Why are we listening to those clips?
All right, well, if you listen closely, and I know you were, the thing all of these scenes have in common is that they're all the moment when we, Earthlings, realize we're not alone.
Wow, that is terrifying and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, well, it could be both. New research from ASU psychology professor Michael Varnum shows it might not be quite so scary. Our co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with him to talk more about it.
So when we talked about this in our meeting, all of us said, well, if we came across alien life, we would obviously bomb them or something terrible would happen. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like we're just kind of negative journalists.
Well, I mean, I didn't really sample many journalists for the research I did. And perhaps you guys are a special population in this regard. But, you know, when we got large samples of the general public and we asked them, you know, how do you think you'll feel or react if we find evidence of alien life? Initially focused on microbial life, which is what scientists think we're more likely to find first, at least, we found that people's responses were much more positive than negative. Hmm. So we had people kind of just free respond. And we ran this through a software program developed by James Pennebaker that can extract things like affective states from written language. And we found this both when people were writing about their own reactions or society's reactions. And we also got this when we had a separate group of participants read media coverage of a past claim that indeed we'd found this kind of life back in 1996 with the Mars meteorite. And as a control, we had another group of participants read about Craig Venter claiming to create synthetic life. And people felt, you know, pretty positive about both types of new life, but more so for novel alien life than novel man-made life.
Synthetic didn't win.
No, synthetic lost in this case.
So when you say freeform answers, do you have any kind of standout answers of ones that you read that you were mm-hmm. like, oh, I love this?
Yeah. So I think my favorite, and I'm paraphrasing here, I would be so excited. I would be thrilled. I would learn everything I could, tell everyone I know, and then I'd go to work.
So it wasn't like this would be groundbreaking in the sense that it would change people's lives.
Right. And, you know, I think oftentimes when people think about major scientific breakthroughs or sort of paradigm shifting ideas, we assume that it'll change everything. Mm-hmm. But in reality, you know, in the past several hundred years, we've learned that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. We've learned about special and general relativity. We've learned about all these freaky things that happen on the quantum scale. We've learned about Darwinian evolution. And yet, you know, humanity kind of continues on the same way it always has, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think we've necessarily seen basic psychological changes as a result, or even necessarily major institutional shifts. So organized religion has survived. The nation state has survived. Economic systems have survived. The institution of marriage has survived.
So you're a social psychologist. So, I mean, in terms of, yes, we'll all go back to work the next day, but, I mean, does it sort of shift things in terms of our understanding of ourselves in the universe?
I guess I'd say yes and no, right? So at an intellectual level, it does shift things. I mean, and so does realizing that the Earth isn't flat and
yeah.
we're spinning around through space and we're one of, you know, thousands of planets, probably millions and billions. But I think evolutionarily, we're programmed to deal with much more immediate concerns.
Hmm.
We don't tend to walk around with our head in the clouds all that often, so to speak. So I think it'll be like many other interesting scientific discoveries, even within our lifetimes, that people think it's neat. They'll talk about it at a cocktail party or at the dinner table. But at the end of the day, it'll fade from the news cycle probably fairly quickly.
Why study this? Like, what made you interested in this? You're not, like you said, a scientist in that way.
Sure. So, my specialization isn't aliens in any way, shape, or form. Though, you know, I read a lot of sci-fi growing up, and I love the X-Files. But I got involved in this thing at ASU called the Interplanetary Initiative, which is this big interdisciplinary push to try to think about what a future is going to look like for humanity in space, or what space exploration is going to, what kind of impact it's going to have on society, right? And try to prepare us. And one of the big initial questions they had is, you know, a lot of astrobiologists think we're on the verge of discovering evidence we're not alone, albeit probably little bacteria or viruses rather than little green men. How will we react? And there's been a lot of speculation about reactions, you know, what this will do to societies, what this will do to individuals, and actually a lot of fear. You know, you can go back to the Robertson panel in the late 40s saying, if we find anything, you know, we have to cover it up because everyone will freak out and society will collapse.
Yes.
But, is you know, 1996, essentially we had a trial run at this, and nothing really dramatic happened in 1996, right? It's not a turning point in terms of, you know, that was the year, you know, our societies totally fell into chaos and everything changed. But, yeah, I got interested in it because I realized there was a lot of speculation, but really no one had tried to approach this in a very rigorous empirical fashion. And granted, I can't create alien life and have you react to it, but I tried to come as close as I could.
Yeah. All right. That is Michael Varnum, Associate Professor of Psychology at ASU. Michael, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
The Arizona Cardinals will play in one of the most anticipated openers since the NFL franchise moved to the Valley more than 30 years ago. After a pretty bad season last year, the Cardinals used the first overall pick in the NFL draft on quarterback Kyler Murray. Along with the new first-year head coach, Murray faces lots of questions on how effective the rookie quarterback can be. Longtime Cardinals receiver Larry Fitzgerald, though, isn't worried.
He's as ready as any of us. I mean, he's been built for this situation. I mean, he's been groomed since he was a child to be, a starting quarterback in the National Football League. I mean, you guys laugh, but you know, honestly, that's his mentality, that's his mindset. You know, he's ready for this.
Joining us now to talk about the debut of the new QB coach and much more is Josh Weinfuss, who covers the Arizona Cardinals for ESPN. Josh, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, bold move, Cliff Kingsbury, Kyler Murray. They didn't show much in the preseason. Are they actually hiding some special offense we're all supposed to get excited about?
To say the least, yeah. So, Cliff Kingsbury comes from an air raid background. An air raid is basically a system of offensive plays that spread the ball out across the field. They play at a high tempo. They don't huddle. So, it's kind of a way to get the ball moving quicker, right? So, he will do part of that. It's his version of the air raid. They haven't run any of it during the preseason, and that was by design. They don't want to put any of it on tape. So what they're going to do week one is unveil a basically a way of playing football that the NFL has not seen before. So the NFL has seen parts of the air raid, components of the air raid, plays of the air raid, but they've never seen the air raid in full. So it's going to be completely different.
So a skeptic might say, if no one in the NFL has used this before, maybe it wasn't worth using. Is that too cynical?
A little bit. I think part of it is the reason it hasn't been used before is because no team has hired a quote-unquote air raid coach. And a lot of that is because the NFL is stubborn. They don't want to change. They think they have all the answers because they are coaching in the NFL. Well, the air raid has been one of the most productive and successful offenses in college football for the last 15, 20 years, right? It was created by Hal Mumme back in the late 80s, and it's been perfected by some of his disciples and some of the disciples from Mike Leach, who is now the head coach at Washington State, who was an assistant under Mumme and helped him design the offense. And it's been run by some of the top teams in college football for the last, especially the last 5 to 10 years. Well, those guys really haven't been given a shot to run it in the NFL because, like I said, NFL's stubborn. But each of those coaches has put their own spin on it. So now we're going to see what Cliff Kingsbury's going to do in terms of putting his own spin on it.
Well, given, as you say, that they haven't really used it at all during the preseason, is it fair to assume it might take a little bit of getting used to for the guys who even know what's coming?
100%. I mean, I think, you know, if you watched the game last night between the Bears and the Packers, you saw a lot of rust. The trend in the NFL these days is not to play your starters throughout the whole preseason, right? Or give them very few reps. So when they get into week one, it's not so much the offense that they have to worry about running, it's their conditioning. These guys haven't played a full four quarters since December. So there's a lot that goes into it beyond just the X's and O's, right? They have to get their stamina up. They have to get used to getting hit on a regular basis. But then for the Cardinals, you add in a new layer, and that's running a new offense at a tempo that really teams don't run in the NFL that often. So a combination of all that could make Sunday very interesting. But I think the fallout, if the offense does not look good, will be a lot of skeptics saying, I told you so. And when in reality, it might just take a few weeks for this to get going.
Josh, we just have a few seconds left. We're not going to ask you for some formal prediction, but do the Cardinals at least do better than last year?
A little bit better. I don't know if they're going to do a ton better, simply just because there's still some major holes on their roster and they're running a new offense. So there's still a lot to be seen. I mean, call me back after next week. After Sunday's game, I might have a totally different opinion because we don't know what's going to be run.
All right. Josh Weinfuss covers the Arizona Cardinals for ESPN. Josh, thanks for some of your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
One of Arizona's most famous musicians is heading to the big screen today.
A biographical documentary of Tucson native Linda Ronstadt is called Linda Ronstadt, The Story of My Voice, and it's out today.
The documentary covers everything from her political activism and her relationship to former California Governor Jerry Brown to her rise to fame and struggles as a trailblazing female artist of the 1970s.
The rock and roll culture seems to be dominated by hostility against women. What happens is that they lose the ability to focus on themselves as a person rather than as an image, you know?
Ronstadt was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2012. She only agreed to let directors make the documentary if they didn't focus on her diagnosis, which has left her unable to sing.
She is featured in the beginning and end of the film doing some voiceover work, but no worries, plenty of recognizable faces there to sing her praises. Emmylou Harris, Dolly Parton, Jackson Brown, and several members of the Eagles, just to name a few.
And the documentary also touches on her background as a Mexican-American raised in Arizona. She went on to win Grammys for the many Mexican folk albums she released and has been vocal about border wall issues of the last few years.
Ronstadt became the highest paid woman in rock and roll by the end of the 70s and is still one of the world's best-selling artists of all time. Her documentary, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, opens today in select theaters. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.